Mind Hunter, Cassette 3.
My best buddy at the time was an agent named Joe Del Campo, who worked with me on bank robbery cases. We would hang around this bagel place on Oakland Avenue near the University of Wisconsin's Milwaukee campus. A couple named David and Sarah Goldberg managed it, and before too long, Joe and I became friendly with them. In fact, they started treating us like sons. Some mornings we'd be in there bright and early, wearing our guns and helping the Goldbergs put bagels and bialys in the oven. We'd eat breakfast, go out and catch a fugitive, follow up on a couple of leads in other cases, then go back for lunch. Joe and I both worked out at the Jewish Community Center, and around Christmas and Hanukkah time, we bought the Goldbergs a membership. Eventually, other agents started hanging around what we simply called Goldberg's Place, and we had a party there, attended by both the SAC and ASAC. Joe Del Campo was a bright guy, multilingual, and excellent with firearms. His prowess played the central role in perhaps the strangest and most confusing situation I've ever been involved with. One day during the winter, Joe and I are in the office interrogating a fugitive we brought in that morning when we get a call that Milwaukee police have a hostage situation. Joe's been up all night on night duty, but we leave our own subject to cool his heels and head out to the scene. When we get there, an old Tudor-style house, we learn that the suspect, Jacob Cohen, is a fugitive accused of killing a police officer in Chicago. He's just shot an FBI agent, Richard Carr, who tried to approach him in his apartment complex, which had been surrounded by a newly trained FBI SWAT team. The crazy guy then ran through the SWAT team perimeter, taking two rounds in the buttocks. He grabs a young boy shoveling snow and runs into a house. Now he's got three hostages, two children and an adult. Ultimately, he lets the adult and one of the kids go. He holds on to the young boy whose age we estimate at about 10 to 12. At this point, everyone's pissed off. It's freezing cold. Cohen is mad as hell, not exactly helped by the fact he's now got an ass full of lead. The FBI and Milwaukee police are angry at each other for letting the situation degenerate. The SWAT team is pissed off because this was their first big case and they missed him and let him slip through their perimeter. The FBI in general is now out for blood because he's taken down one of their own. And Chicago police have already gotten out the word that they want to come get him, and that if anyone's going to shoot the suspect, they should have that right. SAC Herb Hoxie arrives on the scene and makes what I consider a couple of mistakes to compound the ones already made by everyone else. First, he uses a bullhorn, which makes him come across as dictatorial. A private telephone link-up is more sensitive. Plus, it gives you the flexibility of negotiating in private. Then he makes what I consider his second error. He offers himself as hostage in exchange for the boy. So Hoxie gets behind the wheel of an FBI car. The police form a circle around the car as it backs into the driveway. Meanwhile, Del Campo tells me to give him a boost onto the roof of the house. Remember, it's a Tudor with steep sloping roofs that are slick with ice, and Joe's been up all night. The only weapon he's got is his 2.5-inch barrel 357 Magnum. Cohen comes out of the house with his arm wrapped around the boy's head, holding him close to his body. Detective Beasley of the Milwaukee Police Department steps out from the circle of cops and says, "Jack, we've got what you want. Leave the boy alone." Del Campo is still creeping up the pitch of the roof. The police see him up there and realize what he's up to. The subject and the hostage are getting closer to the car. There's ice and snow everywhere. Then suddenly, the kid slips on the ice, causing Cohen to lose his grip on him. Del Campo comes up over the peak of the roof. Figuring that with the short barrel, the bullet may rise, he aims for the neck and gets off one shot. It's a direct hit, an amazing shot, right in the middle of the subject's neck. Cohen goes down, but no one can tell whether he's been hit or if it's the boy. Exactly 3 seconds later, The car is riddled with bullets. In the crossfire, Detective Beasley is hit in the Achilles tendon. The boy scrambles on his hands and knees in front of the car, which rolls forward on him because Hoxie's been hit by flying glass and has lost control. Fortunately, the boy's not badly hurt. True to FBI form, the local TV news that night shows the special agent in charge, Herbert Hoxie, on a gurney, being moved out of the emergency room with blood trickling from his ear, and while they're wheeling him away, he's giving his statement to the press. All of a sudden, I heard gunfire. Bullets were flying everywhere. I guess I was hit, but I think I'm okay. FBI, God, motherhood, apple pie, etc., etc. But that wasn't the end of it. Fistfights nearly break out, and the police almost beat up Del Campo for taking their shot. The SWAT team isn't any too pleased either, because he's made them look bad. They go to the ASAC, Ed Best, to complain, but he stands up for Del Campo and says that Joe salvaged the situation that they let develop. Cohen had between 30 and 40 entrance and exit wounds, but was still alive when they took him away in the ambulance. Fortunately for all concerned, he was DOA at the hospital. Special Agent Carr miraculously survived. Cohen's bullet passed through the trench coat Carr was wearing, into his shoulder, ricocheted off his trachea, and lodged in his lung. Carr kept that trench coat with the bullet hole in it, and wore it proudly from that day on. Del Campo and I were a terrific team for a while, except when we'd get on these laughing jags we couldn't get off of. We were at a gay bar once, trying to develop some informants on a homosexual murder fugitive. It's dark, and it takes our eyes some time to adjust. Suddenly, we become aware of all these eyes on us, and we start arguing about which one of us they want. Then we see this sign above the bar, "A hard man is good to find," and we just lose it, cracking up like two goofballs. It never took much. We broke up once talking to an old guy in a wheelchair at a nursing home, and again, interviewing a dapper business owner in his mid-40s whose toupee had slipped halfway down his forehead. It didn't matter. If there was any humor anywhere in a situation, Joe and I would find it. As insensitive as it may sound, this was probably a useful talent to have. When you spend your time looking at murder scenes and dump sites, especially those involving children, when you've talked to hundreds, then thousands of victims and their families, when you've seen the absolutely incredible things some human beings are capable of doing to other human beings, you'd better be able to laugh at silly things. Otherwise, you're going to go crazy. Unlike a lot of guys who went into law enforcement, I'd never been a gun nut. But ever since the Air Force, I'd always been a good shot. I thought it might be interesting to be on the SWAT team for a while. Every field office had one. It was a part-time job. The five team members were called out as needed. I made the team and was assigned as the sniper, the one who stays farthest back and goes for the long shot. All the others on the team had heavy military backgrounds, Green Berets, Rangers, and here I had taught swimming to pilots' wives and kids. The team leader, David Cole, eventually became a deputy assistant director at Quantico, and he was the one who asked me to head up the investigative support unit. In one case, somewhat more straightforward than the Jacob Cohen extravaganza, a guy robbed a bank, then led police on a high-speed chase, ending up barricaded in a warehouse. That was when we were called in. Inside this warehouse, he takes off all his clothes, then puts them back on again. He seems like a real nutcase. Then he asks to have his wife brought to the scene, which they do. In later years, when we'd done more research into this type of personality, we'd understand that you don't do that. You don't agree to this type of demand because the person they ask to see is usually the one whom they perceive as having precipitated the problem in the first place. Therefore, you're putting that individual in great danger and setting them up for a murder-suicide. Fortunately, in this instance, they don't bring her inside the warehouse, but have her talk to him on the phone. And sure enough, as soon as he hangs up, he blows his brains out with a shotgun. We'd all been waiting in position for several hours, and suddenly it was over. But you can't always diffuse stress that quickly, which often leads to warped humor. "Geez, why'd he have to do that?" one of the guys remarked. "Douglas is a crackerjack shot. He could have done that for him." I was in Milwaukee for a little more than 5 years. Eventually, Pam and I moved from the apartment on Juneau Avenue to a townhouse on Brown Deer Road, away from the office, near the northern city limit. I spent most of my time on bank robberies and built up a string of commendations clearing cases. I found I was most successful when I could come up with a signature linking several crimes together, a factor that later became the cornerstone of our serial murder analysis. My only notable screw-up during this time was after Jerry Hogan replaced Herb Hoxie as SAC. Not many perks went along with the job, but one was a bureau automobile, and Hogan was proud of his new emerald green Ford LTD. I needed a car for an investigation one day, and none was available. Hogan was out at a meeting, so I asked the ASAC, Arthur Fulton, if I could use the SAC's. Reluctantly, he agreed. The next thing I know, Jerry's called me into his office and he's yelling at me for using his car, getting it dirty, and worst of all, bringing it back with a flat. I hadn't even noticed that. Now, Jerry and I got along well, so the whole time he's yelling, I can't keep from laughing. Apparently, this was a mistake. Later that day, my squad supervisor, Ray Byrne, says to me, "You know, John, Jerry Hogan really likes you, but he has to teach you a lesson. He's assigning you to the Indian reservation." These were the days of the Wounded Knee incident and the groundswell of consciousness over Native American rights. We were hated on the reservations, as much as in the ghettos of Detroit. The Indians had been treated terribly by the government. When I first arrived at the Menominee Reservation up on Green Bay, I couldn't believe the poverty and filth and squalor these people had to live in. So much of their culture had been stripped away from them, they often seemed almost numb to me. Largely as a result of the deplorable conditions and the history of government hostility and indifference. On many of the reservations you saw high incidences of alcoholism, child and spouse abuse, assault and murder. But because of the utter mistrust of the government, it was nearly impossible for an FBI agent to get any type of cooperation or assistance from witnesses. The local Bureau of Indian Affairs representatives were of no help. Even family members of victims wouldn't get involved, for fear of being seen as collaborating with the enemy. Sometimes, by the time you would find out about a murder and get to the scene, the body would have been there for several days already, infested with insect larvae. I spent more than a month on the reservation, during which time I investigated at least 6 murders. I felt so bad for these people. I was depressed all the time, and I had the luxury of leaving and going home at night. I'd just never seen people who, as a group, had so much to overcome. While it was dicey, my time on the Menominee Reservation was the first concentrated dose of murder scene investigation I'd had, which turned out to be grim but excellent experience. Without question, the best thing that happened during my time in Milwaukee was the birth of our first child, Erica, in November of 1975. We were to have Thanksgiving dinner at a local country club with some friends, Sam and Esther Ruskin, when Pam went into labor. Erica was born the next day. I was working long hours on bank robbery cases and finishing up my graduate degree, and the new baby meant even less sleep. But needless to say, Pam bore the brunt of this. I felt much more family-oriented responsibility as a result of fatherhood, and I loved watching Erica grow. Fortunately for all of us, I think, I had not yet begun working child abduction and murder. If I had been, if I'd really stopped and thought about what was out there, I don't know that I could have adjusted to fatherhood as comfortably. By the time our next child, Lauren, was born in 1980, I was well into it. Becoming a father, I think, also motivated me to try to make more out of myself. I knew that what I was doing wasn't what I wanted to be doing my entire career. Jerry Hogan advised me to put in 10 years in the field before I thought about applying for anything else. That way, I'd have the experience for an ASAC and eventually an SAC posting. Then maybe eventually make it to headquarters. But with one child, and I hoped more to come, the life of a field agent moving from office to office didn't seem terribly appealing. As time went on, other perspectives about the job began to evolve. The sniper training and SWAT team exercises had lost their appeal. With my background and interest in psychology, I had my master's by this time. The challenging part of the work, it seemed to me, was trying to manage the situation before it got to the shooting stage. The SAC recommended me for a 2-week hostage negotiation course at the FBI Academy in Quantico, which had only been in operation for a couple of years. There, under the tutelage of such legendary agents as Howard Tetton and Pat Mullaney, I got my first real exposure to what was already known then as behavioral science. And that changed my career. Chapter 5. Behavioral Science, or BS? I hadn't been back to Quantico since New Ancient Training almost 5 years before, and in many ways the place had changed. For one thing, by spring of 1975, the FBI Academy had become a complete and self-contained facility, carved out of a chunk of the U.S. Marine base in the beautiful, gently rolling Virginia woodlands, about an hour south of Washington. But some things hadn't changed. The tactical units still commanded all the prestige and status, and of these, the firearms unit was the star. It was headed by George Zeiss, the special agent who had been sent to bring James Earl Ray back from England to face American justice after the 1968 assassination of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr. Zeiss was a huge, powerful bear of a man who broke handcuffs with his bare hands as a parlor trick. One time, some of the guys on the range took a pair and soldered the chain, then gave them to Zeiss to do his thing. He twisted so hard, he snapped his wrist and had to be in a cast for weeks. Hostage negotiation was taught by the Behavioral Science Unit, a group of between 7 and 9 special agent instructors. Psychology and the soft sciences were never held in much esteem by Hoover and his cohorts, so until he died, this was something of a backroom endeavor. In fact, much of the FBI at that time, as well as the law enforcement world in general, considered psychology and behavioral science, as they applied to criminology, to be so much worthless bullshit. While clearly I never felt this way, I had to acknowledge that a lot of what was known and taught in this field had no real relevance to the business of understanding and catching criminals, a circumstance several of us would try to begin to rectify a couple of years later. When I took over as chief of the operational side of the Behavioral Science Unit, I changed the name to the Investigative Support Unit. And when people asked me why, I told them quite frankly, I wanted to take the BS out of what we were doing. The BSU, under Unit Chief Jack Pfaff, at the time I took my hostage negotiation training, was dominated by two strong and insightful personalities, Howard Tetton and Patrick Mullaney. Tetton is about 6'4", with penetrating eyes behind wire-rimmed glasses. Though an ex-Marine, he's a contemplative type, always totally dignified, the model of an intellectual professor. He joined the Bureau in 1962 after serving with the San Leandro, California Police Department near San Francisco. In 1969, he began teaching a landmark course called Applied Criminology, which eventually, after Hoover's death, I suspect, became known as Applied Criminal Psychology. By 1972, Tetton had gone up to New York to consult with Dr. James Brussel, the psychiatrist who had cracked the Mad Bomber case, who agreed to personally teach Tetton his profiling technique. Armed with this knowledge, the big breakthrough of Tetton's approach was how much you could learn about criminal behavior and motives by focusing on the evidence of the crime scene. In some ways, everything we've done in behavioral science and criminal investigative analysis since then has been based on this. Pat Mullaney always reminded me of a leprechaun. At about 5'10", he's a roly-poly type with a quick wit and high energy level. He came to Quantico in 1972 from the New York field office with a degree in psychology. Near the end of his tenure at Quantico, he would distinguish himself by successfully managing very public hostage situations. In Washington, D.C., when the Hanafi Muslim sect took over the B'nai B'rith headquarters, and in Warrensville Heights, Ohio, when Corey Moore, a black Vietnam vet, grabbed a police captain and his secretary right in the station house. Together, Tetton and Mullaney represented the first wave of modern behavioral science and made a distinct and unforgettable pair. The other instructors at the BSU also participated in the hostage negotiation course. These included Dick Ault and Robert Ressler, who arrived at Quantico a short time before. If Tetton and Mullaney constituted the first wave, Ault and Ressler constituted the second, moving the discipline further along as something that could be of real value to police departments throughout the United States and the world. Though at that time we only knew each other as teacher and student, Bob Ressler and I would soon join forces on the serial killer study that led ultimately to the modern version of what we do. About 50 guys were in the hostage negotiation class. In some ways it was more entertaining than informative, but an enjoyable 2-week respite from fieldwork. In class, we examined the 3 basic types of hostage takers: professional criminal, mentally ill, and fanatic. We studied some of the significant phenomena that had arisen out of hostage situations, such as the Stockholm Syndrome. 2 years before, in 1973, a botched bank robbery in Stockholm, Sweden, had turned into an agonizing hostage drama for customers and bank employees. Ultimately, the hostages came to identify with their captors and actually assisted them against the police. We also watched the Sidney Lumet film Dog Day Afternoon, which had recently come out, starring Al Pacino as a man who robs a bank to get money for his male lover to undergo a sex change operation. The film is based on an actual hostage incident in New York City. It was this case and the protracted negotiations that ensued that led the FBI to invite Captain Frank Boltz and Detective Harvey Schlossberg of the NYPD to bring the Academy up to speed on hostage negotiation, an area in which the New York people were the acknowledged national leaders. We studied the principles of negotiation. Some of the guidelines, such as trying to keep loss of life to a minimum, were obvious stuff. We did have the benefit of audio tapes of actual hostage situations. But it would be years later, when the next generation of instructors came in, before students would be involved in role-playing exercises, the closest you can get in the classroom to hands-on negotiating. It was also somewhat confusing, because a lot of the material had been recycled from the criminal psychology classes and didn't really fit. For example, they would give us photos and dossiers of child molesters or lust killers, and discuss how such a personality would react in a hostage situation. Then, there was more firearms training, which was still the big thing at Quantico. Much of what we eventually came to teach about hostage negotiation was learned not in the classroom from other agents, but in the cold crucible of the field. As I mentioned, one of the cases that earned Pat Mullaney his reputation was that of Corey Moore. Moore, who'd been diagnosed a paranoid schizophrenic, made a number of public demands after taking the Warrensville Heights, Ohio police captain and his secretary hostage in the captain's own office. Among them was that all white people leave the earth immediately. Now, In negotiating strategy, you don't want to give in to demands if you can possibly help it. Some demands, however, aren't terribly feasible under any circumstances. This certainly qualified as one of those. The case got so much national attention that the President of the United States, Jimmy Carter, offered to speak with Moore and help resolve the situation. While this was certainly well-intentioned on Mr. Carter's part, and indicative of the willingness he subsequently demonstrated for attempting to settle seemingly intractable conflicts around the world, this was not good negotiating strategy, and I would never want it to happen in a situation I was managing. Neither did Pat Mullaney. The problem with offering up the top guy, in addition to encouraging other desperate little people to try the same thing, is that you lose your maneuvering room. You always want to negotiate through intermediaries, which allows you to stall for time and avoid making promises you don't want to keep. Once you put the hostage taker in direct contact with someone he perceives as a decision maker, everyone's backed against the wall, and if you don't give in to his demands, you risk having things head south in a hurry. The longer you keep them talking, the better. By the time I was teaching hostage negotiation at Quantico in the early 1980s, we used a disturbing videotape that had been made in St. Louis a couple of years before. Ultimately, we stopped showing it because the St. Louis Police Department was so upset by it. In the tape, a young black man holds up a bar. The robbery's a bust. He gets trapped inside. The police surround the place, and he's got a bunch of hostages. The police organize a team of black and white officers to talk to him. But as the tape shows, rather than trying to deal with him on an objective level, they start jive-talking him and trying to get down on his level. They're all talking at once, constantly interrupting him, not listening to what he's saying, not trying to figure out what he wants to get out of this situation. The camera swings away just as the chief of police arrives on the scene. Again, I'd never let this happen. Once the chief is there, he officially ignores the demands, whereupon the guy points the gun at his own head and blows his brains out for all to see. Contrast that with Pat Mullaney's handling of the Corey Moore case. Obviously, Moore was crazy, and obviously, all the white people weren't going to leave planet Earth. But by listening to the subject, Mullaney was able to discern what Moore really wanted and what would satisfy him. Mullaney offered Moore a press conference in which to air his views, and Moore released the hostages bloodlessly. During the course at Quantico, my name got around the Behavioral Science Unit, and Pat Mullaney, Dick Ault, and Bob Ressler recommended me to Jack Pfaff. Before I left, the unit chief called me down to his basement office for an interview. Pfaff was a personable, friendly guy. A swarthy chain smoker, he looked a lot like Victor Mature. He told me the instructors had been impressed with me, and told me to consider coming back to Quantico as a counselor for the FBI National Academy program. I was flattered by the offer and said I'd very much like to do that. Back in Milwaukee, I was still on the reactive squad and the SWAT team, but was spending much of my time going around the state training business executives on how to deal with kidnapping and extortion threats, and bank officers on how to deal with the single bandit and gang-armed robberies that were plaguing rural banks particularly. It was amazing how naive some of these sophisticated businessmen were about personal security, allowing their schedules, even their vacation plans, to be published in local newspapers and company newsletters. In many cases, they were sitting ducks for would-be kidnappers and extortionists. I tried to teach them and their secretaries and subordinates how to evaluate calls and requests for information, and how to determine whether an extortion call that came in was genuine or not. For example, it wasn't unusual for an executive to get a call that his wife or child had been kidnapped, and that he was to take a certain amount of money to such and such a drop. In point of fact, that wife or child was perfectly safe and in no danger the entire time, but the would-be profiteer had known that the family member would be unreachable for whatever reason, and if the criminal had one or two legitimate-sounding facts, he could convince the panicked executive to accede to his demands. By the same token, we were able to cut down on the success of bank robberies by getting officials to institute some simple procedures. One of the common robbery techniques was to wait outside early in the morning when the branch manager would arrive to open for the day. The subject would grab the guy, then, as other unsuspecting employees would arrive for work, they'd be taken too. The next thing you know, you have a whole bank branch full of hostages and a major mess on your hands. I got some of the branches to institute a basic code system. When the first person arrived in the morning and found that the coast was clear, he or she would do one thing. Adjust a curtain, move a plant, turn on a particular light, whatever, to signal to everyone else that all was okay. If that signal was absent when the second person arrived, he or she would not go in, but would call the police immediately. Likewise, we train tellers, who are the real key to any bank's security, what to look for and what to do in panic situations without becoming dead heroes. We explained the proper handling of exploding money packs, which were just then going into wide usage. And based on the interviews I'd done with a number of successful bank robbers, I instructed tellers to take the hold-up note as it was presented to them, then, nervously, drop it on the floor on their side of the cage rather than hand it back to the robber, thereby preserving a valuable piece of evidence. I knew from my interviews that robbers don't like to hit banks cold, so it could be extremely valuable to make a note of individuals coming into the branch whom you've never seen before, particularly with a simple or routine request, such as the exchange of paper money for a roll of dimes. If the teller had been able to jot down a license number or noted any kind of ID, a subsequent robbery could often be solved quickly. I'd begun hanging out with city homicide detectives and around the medical examiner's office. Any forensic pathologist, as well as most good detectives, will tell you that the single most important piece of evidence in any murder investigation is the victim's body, and I wanted to learn as much as I could. I'm sure part of the fascination also went back to my youthful days of wanting to be a veterinarian and to understand how the structures and functions of the body related to living. But though I enjoyed working both with the homicide squad and the ME's staff, what really interested me was the psychological side. What makes a killer tick? What makes him commit a murder under the particular circumstances he does? During my weeks at Quantico, I'd been exposed to some of the most bizarre murder cases, and one of the most bizarre of all turned out to be practically in my backyard. Actually, about 140 miles away, but that was close enough. Back in the 1950s, Edward Gine had been a recluse living in the farming community of Plainfield, Wisconsin. Population, 642. He'd begun his criminal career quietly as a grave robber. His particular interest was the corpse's skin, which he removed, tanned, and draped across his own body, in addition to adorning a tailor's dummy and various home furnishings. At one point, he'd considered a sex change operation, still revolutionary in the Midwest of the 1950s, and when that seemed impractical, decided on the next best thing, which was making himself a woman's suit out of real women. Some speculate he was trying to become his dead, domineering mother. If this case is starting to sound familiar, aspects of it were used by both Robert Bloch in his novel Psycho, made into the Hitchcock film classic, and Thomas Harris in The Silence of the Lambs. Harris picked up the story while sitting in on our classes at Quantico. Gine could probably have continued living in ghoulish obscurity had his fantasy needs not expanded into creating more corpses to harvest. When we began our serial killer study, this escalation is something we came to recognize in virtually all cases. Gine was charged with the murder of two middle-aged women, though likely there were more. In January of 1958, he was found legally insane, and then spent the rest of his life in the Central State Hospital at Waupun and the Mendota Mental Health Institute, where he was always a model prisoner. In 1984, Gein died peacefully at age 77 in the Mendota Geriatric Ward. Needless to say, as a local detective or a special agent in the field, you don't get to see this sort of thing too often. When I got back to Milwaukee, I wanted to learn as much about the case as I could. But when I checked with the State Attorney General's office, I found that the records had been sealed because of the insanity angle. Saying I was an FBI agent with an educational interest in the crimes, I got the office to open the files to me. I'll never forget going with the clerk and taking the boxes off the endless shelves and actually having to break a wax seal to get in. But inside, I saw photographs that instantly became seared in my mind. Headless, naked female bodies, hung upside down by ropes and pulleys, slit open in front all the way from sternum to vaginal area with all genitalia cut out. Other photos showed several heads lying on the table, their blank, open eyes staring into nothingness. As horrible as these images were to contemplate, I began speculating as to what they said about the person who had created them, and how that knowledge could have aided in his capture. And in a real sense, I've been contemplating that ever since. At the end of September 1976, I left Milwaukee for my temporary duty assignment, or TDY, as a counselor for the 107th National Academy session at Quantico. Pam had to stay on her own in Milwaukee, running the house and taking care of one-year-old Erica while still teaching. This was the first of my many professional absences over the years, and I'm afraid too many of us in the Bureau, in the military, and in the Foreign Service give too little thought to the incredible burdens on the spouse left behind. The FBI National Academy program is a tough, 11-week course for senior and accomplished law enforcement officials from around the nation and the world. In many cases, Academy students are trained right alongside FBI agents. The way to tell the difference between trainees is by shirt color. FBI agents wear blue, while NA students wear red. Another thing, NA students tend to be older and more experienced. To qualify, you have to be recommended by your local commanding officer and accepted by the Quantico staff. Not only does the National Academy provide expert training in the latest in law enforcement knowledge and techniques, it also serves as an extended and informal environment for the FBI to build personal relationships with local police officers, which has proved an invaluable resource over and over again. The head of the National Academy program was Jim Cotter, a real law enforcement institution whom the police loved. As a counselor, I was responsible for one section of students, Section B, consisting of 50 men. Even though Director Patrick Gray's and then Clarence Kelly's policies were opening the Bureau from the narrow strictures of the Hoover years, no women were yet invited to the National Academy. In addition to the Americans, I had people from England, Canada, and Egypt. You live in the same dormitories, and you're expected to be everything from instructor to social director to therapist to den mother. It was a way for the behavioral science staff to see how you interacted with police, if you liked the atmosphere at Quantico, and how you handled stress. And there was plenty of that. Away from their families and living in dorm rooms for the first time in their adult lives, unable to drink in their rooms, sharing the bathroom with people they'd never met before, pushed to physical challenges most of them hadn't had to endure since new recruit training, the students got an excellent education, but at a price. By about the sixth week, many of the cops were going nuts, bouncing off the white cinder block walls. And this, of course, took its toll on the counselors as well. Each one handled the assignment differently. As with everything else in my life, I decided that if we were all going to get through this in one piece, I'd better have a sense of humor. Some counselors took other approaches. One was so strict and intense, he'd be chewing his guys' butts out during intramural games. By the third week, his section was so pissed off, they gave him a set of luggage, the symbolic message being, "Get the hell out of here." Another counselor was a special agent I'll call Fred. He'd never had a drinking problem until he came to Quantico, but he sure got one there. The counselors were all supposed to watch for signs of students becoming depressed. In fact, Fred had taken to locking himself in his room, smoking and drinking himself into oblivion. When you're dealing with street-hardened cops, it's survival of the fittest. Any weakness and you're dead meat. A really nice guy, Fred was so sensitive and understanding and gullible, he didn't stand a chance with this crew. There was a standing rule: no women on the floor. One night, one of the cops comes to Fred saying he can't take it anymore. That's not something you want to hear as a counselor. His roommate has a different woman in bed every night, and he can't sleep. So Fred goes with the guy to the room and sees half a dozen other men standing outside the door waiting their turn, holding money in their sweaty hands. Fred freaks. He barges in on the guy who's on top of this long-haired blonde, grabs him, and pulls him off the woman, who turns out to be an inflatable doll. 1 week later, another cop comes to Fred's room in the middle of the night saying his depressed roommate Harry has just opened the window and jumped. First of all, the windows in the dorm building aren't supposed to open. So Fred races down the hall into the room, peers out the open window, and sees Harry covered with blood lying on the grass. Fred races down the stairs and out to the suicide scene, whereupon Harry jumps up and scares the shit out of him. It happens a bottle of ketchup had been appropriated from the cafeteria that very night. By graduation, Fred's hair was falling out, he wasn't shaving, his leg was numb, and he was walking with a limp. A neurologist could find nothing clinically wrong with him. A year later, back in his field office, he was out on a medical disability discharge. I felt sorry for the guy, but in one respect at least, cops are a lot like criminals. You've got to prove how tough you are with each. Despite my easygoing and humorous approach, I wasn't immune either, though fortunately, most of it was camp stuff. On one occasion, my group removed all the furniture from my room. On another, they short-sheeted my bed. And on several more, they stretched cellophane across my toilet seat. You have to be able to relieve stress somehow.
This ends side one of cassette three. Please turn the cassette over and start side two at the same point.
There came a point when they were driving me nuts. I was desperate to get away for a little while. And like the good cops they were, they sensed that moment precisely. They propped my green MGB up with cinder blocks, lifting it just enough off the ground so that the wheels missed by a small fraction of an inch. I get in, turn on the engine. I pop the clutch, put the car in gear, and futilely gun the engine, unable to figure out why I'm going nowhere fast. I get out, cursing at the damn British engineering. I open the hood, I kick the tires, I bend down and look under the car. And all of a sudden, the entire parking lot is lit up. They're all in their cars shining their headlights at me. Since they claim to like me, they actually put the car back on terra firma for me after they'd had their fun. The foreign students were in for their share, too. A lot of these guys would come over with empty suitcases, go to the PX, and buy like crazy. I particularly remember one high-ranking Egyptian colonel. He'd asked a cop from Detroit what fuck meant. Big mistake. The cop had told him, somewhat accurately, that this was an all-purpose word that had many, many different usages, depending on the situation, but it was almost always appropriate. One of its meanings is beautiful or classy. So he's in the PX, goes over to the photography counter, points, and booms out, "I wish to buy that fucking camera." The horrified young woman clerk says, "Excuse me? I want to buy that fucking camera." Some of the other guys quickly get to him and explain that while the term does have many usages, it's not used around women and children. Then there was the Japanese police officer who had dutifully asked one of the other cops the protocol for greeting instructors one holds in high regard. So every time I saw him in the hallway, he would smile, bow respectfully, and greet me with, "Fuck you, Mr. Douglas." Rather than getting all complicated, I'd bow back, smile, and say, "Fuck you, too." Generally, when the Japanese sent over someone to the National Academy, they would insist on sending two students. After a while, it became clear that one would be the superior officer, and the other a subordinate who would be responsible for shining the senior man's shoes, making his bed, cleaning his room, and generally acting as his servant. One time, several of the other students went to Jim Cotter and complained that the top guy was regularly practicing his karate and martial arts by beating the hell out of his companion. Cotter took the top guy aside, explained that every student was equal at the academy, and stated in no uncertain terms that this kind of behavior wouldn't be tolerated. But it just goes to prove the kind of cultural barriers that have to be overcome. I sat in on NA classes and got a sense of how they were taught. By the end of the session in December, both the behavioral science and education units offered me jobs. The education unit chief offered to pay for more graduate school, but I thought I'd be more interested in behavioral science. I came back to Milwaukee a week before Christmas, so confident I'd be getting the posting to Quantico, that Pam and I bought a 5-acre lot in an area south of the FBI Academy in Quantico. In January 1977, the Bureau announced a manpower study, during which time personnel transfers would be frozen. So there went my new job. I was stuck with this lot in Virginia and had to borrow money from my dad for the down payment, and I still had no idea what my future in the Bureau was going to be. But then, several weeks later, I'm out on a case with an agent named Henry McCaslin when I get a call from headquarters that I'm going to be transferred to Quantico in June and assigned to behavioral science. At 32 years of age, I would be taking the place of Pat Mullaney, who was going on to the inspection staff at headquarters. Those were big shoes to fill, and I looked forward to the challenge. My only real concern was the people I'd be teaching. I knew how they could take apart counselors, even ones they liked. I could only imagine how tough they'd be on instructors who were trying to teach them their own business. I had the right dance down, but I wasn't sure if I knew the song well enough. If I was going to be teaching them behavioral science, I'd better figure out some way to eliminate as much of the BS as I could. And if I was going to be able to say anything of value to a police chief 15 or 20 years older than me, I knew I'd better have the goods to back it up. And it was that fear that led me to the next stage of the journey. Chapter 6. Taking the Show on the Road. 9 special agents were assigned to behavioral science when I joined the unit in June of 1977. All primarily involved in teaching. The main course offered to both FBI personnel and National Academy students was applied criminal psychology. Howard Tetten had originated it back in 1972, focusing on the issue with which detectives and other crime solvers are most concerned: motive. The idea was to try to give students an understanding of why violent criminals think and act as they do. Yet as popular and useful as this course was, It was based mainly on research and teaching from the academic discipline of psychology. Some of the material came from Tetten's own experience, and later that of the other instructors. But at the time, the only ones who could speak from the authority of organized, methodical, broadly conducted studies were the academics. And there was a dawning realization among many of us that these studies and this professional perspective had only limited applicability to the field of law enforcement and crime detection. Other courses offered at the Academy included contemporary police problems, which dealt with labor management issues, police unions, community relations, and associated topics. Sociology and psychology, which mirrored the typical introductory college curriculum. And sex crimes, which often, unfortunately, was more entertaining than useful or informative. Depending on who was teaching sex crimes, it was taken with greater or lesser seriousness. One of the instructors set the tone with a dirty old man doll dressed in a raincoat. When you pushed down the head, the raincoat flashed open and the penis popped up. They would also show hundreds of photographs of people with various types of what are now called paraphilias, but were then generally known simply as perversions. Transvestism, various fetishes, exhibitionism, and so on. These would often elicit an inappropriate laugh from the room. When you're dealing with voyeurism or showing a man dressed in women's clothing, you might be able to squeeze a few chuckles out of a particular photo. When you get into the extremes of sadomasochism or pedophilia, if you're still laughing, then there's something wrong with you or the instructor or both. It took several long years and a lot of sensitization before Roy Hazelwood and Ken Lanning came in and put the study of such topics as rape and the sexual exploitation of children on a serious and professional level. Hazelwood is retired now, but still an active consultant, and Lanning will retire soon. These two guys remain among the leading law enforcement experts in the world in their respective fields. But back in the just-the-facts-ma'am Hoover days, no one in any position of authority considered what became known as profiling to be a valid crime-solving tool. In fact, the very phrase, behavioral science, would have been considered an oxymoron, and its proponents might as well have been advocating witchcraft or psychic visions. So anyone dabbling in it would have had to do so very informally, with no records kept. When Tetten and Mullaney began offering personality profiles, it was all done verbally, nothing on paper. The first rule was, always, don't embarrass the Bureau, and you never wanted to document something that could blow up in your or your SAC's face. Through Tetten's initiative, and based on what he'd learned from Dr. Brussel in New York, some informal consulting was provided to individual police officials who requested it. But there was no organized program, nor any thought that this was a function the behavioral science unit should perform. What normally happened was that a graduate of the NA course would call Tetten or Mullaney to talk about a case he was having trouble with. One of the early ones came from a police officer in California, desperate to solve the case of a woman who'd been murdered by multiple stab wounds. Other than the viciousness of the killing, nothing in particular stood out, and there wasn't much to go on forensically. When the officer described the few facts he had, Tetten advised him to start looking in the victim's own neighborhood for a slightly built, unattractive loner in his late teens who'd killed the woman impulsively and was now wrestling with tremendous guilt and fear of being found out. When you go to his house and he comes to the door, Tetten suggested, just stand there, stare right at him, and say, "You know why I'm here." It shouldn't be difficult to get a confession out of him. 2 days later, the officer called back and reported that they'd begun systematically knocking on doors in the neighborhood. When a kid fitting Tetten's profile answered at one house, before the cop could get out his rehearsed line, the young man blurted out, "Okay, you got me." While it probably seemed at the time that Tetten was pulling rabbits out of a hat, there was a logic to the type of individual and situation he described. And over the years, we would make that logic more and more rigorous and make what he and Pat Mullaney were dabbling with in their spare time an important weapon in the fight against violent crime. As is often true with advances in a particular field, this one came about largely by serendipity. The serendipity in this case was that as a behavioral science unit instructor, I really didn't think I knew what I was doing, and felt I needed a way to get more first-hand information. By the time I got to Quantico, Mullaney was just about to leave, and Tetton was the overall guru. So responsibility for breaking me in fell to the two guys closest to me in age and seniority, Dick Ault and Bob Ressler. Dick was about 6 years older than I was, and Bob about 8. Both had done police work in the Army before joining the Bureau. Applied criminal psychology represented about 40 hours of classroom instruction over the 11 weeks of the National Academy course. So the most efficient way of breaking in a new guy was with the Rhodes Schools, where instructors from Quantico taught the same types of courses in highly compressed form to local police departments throughout the United States. These were popular, and there was usually a waiting list of requests for our services, mainly from chiefs and senior people who'd been through the full N.A. course. Going out with a seasoned instructor and watching him perform for 2 weeks was a quick way of picking up what it was you were supposed to be doing. So I started traveling with Bob. There was a standard drill to the Rhodes Schools. You'd leave home on Sunday, teach at one department or academy from Monday morning to Friday noon, then move on to the next school and do it all again. After a while, you started to feel like Shane or the Lone Ranger, riding into town, doing your bit to help the locals, then silently riding out again when your work was done. Sometimes I wanted to leave a silver bullet for them to remember us by. Right from the beginning, I felt uncomfortable about what amounted to teaching from hearsay. Most of the instructors, myself prime among them, had no direct experience with the vast majority of the cases they taught. In that way, it was very much like a college course in criminology where, in most cases, the professor has never been out in the streets experiencing the kind of things he's talking about. Much of the course had evolved into war stories, told originally by whoever the officers on the cases had been, then embellished over time, until they had little relationship to the actual events. By the time I came on the scene, it had gotten to the point where an instructor would make a pronouncement about a particular case, only to be contradicted in class by a student who had actually worked the case. The worst part of it was, the instructor wouldn't always back down, but would often insist he was right, even in the face of someone who'd been there. This kind of technique and attitude can go a long way toward making your class lose faith in everything else you say, whether they have any personal knowledge or not. My other problem was that I had just turned 32 years of age and looked even younger. I was supposed to be teaching experienced cops, many of them 10 and 15 years older. How was I going to sound authoritative or teach them anything? Most of the first-hand experience I had in murder investigation had been under the wings of seasoned homicide cops in Detroit and Milwaukee. And here I was going to be telling people like them how to do their jobs. So I figured I'd better know my shit before I face these guys, and whatever I didn't know, I'd better learn in a hurry. I wasn't stupid about it. Before I would start a session, I would ask if anyone in the class had any direct experience with any of the cases or criminals I planned on discussing that day. For example, if I was going to be discussing Charles Manson, the first thing I'd ask was, "Anyone here from LAPD? Anyone here work this case?" And if there happened to be someone, I'd ask him to give us all the details of the case. That way, I'd make sure I didn't contradict anything that an actual participant would know to be true. But still, even though you might be a 32-year-old kid fresh out of a field office, when you taught at Quantico or came to teach from Quantico, you were presumed to speak with the authority of the FBI Academy and all of its impressive resources. Cops would constantly come up to me during breaks or during road schools, call my hotel room in the evenings, asking for pointers on active cases. Hey, John, I've got this case that's kind of similar to what you were talking about today. What do you think about this? There was no let-up. And I needed some authority for what I was doing. Not authority from the Bureau, but personal authority. Now, there comes a point on the road, at least there did for me, when you realize there are only so many songs you can listen to, so many margaritas you can drink, so much time you can hang around the room staring at the television. That point came for me in a hotel cocktail lounge in California early in 1978. Bob Ressler and I were doing a school in Sacramento. The next day, driving away, I commented that most of these guys we're teaching about are still around, and most of them are going to be on ice for the rest of their lives. Let's see if we can talk to them, ask them why they did it, find out what it was like through their eyes. All we can do is try. If it doesn't work out, it doesn't work out. I'd long had a reputation as a blue flamer, and this didn't do much to diminish it in Bob's eyes. But he did agree to go along with my crazy idea. Bob's motto has always been, "It's better to ask for forgiveness than permission." And that certainly seemed to apply here. We knew if we asked for sanction from headquarters, we wouldn't get it. Not only that, anything we tried to do from then on would be scrutinized. In any bureaucracy, you have to watch blue flamers carefully. California has always had more than its share of weird and spectacular crimes, so that seemed like a good place to start. John Conway was a special agent assigned to the FBI resident agency in San Rafael, just north of San Francisco. He'd had Bob for a class at Quantico, had excellent relations with the California State Penal System, and agreed to act as liaison and make the arrangements for us. We knew we needed to have someone we trusted, and who trusted us, because if this little project blew up in everyone's face, there would be plenty of blame to go around. The first felon we decided to go for was Ed Kemper, who at the time was serving out his multiple life sentences at the California State Medical Facility at Vacaville, about midway between San Francisco and Sacramento. We'd been teaching his case at the National Academy without ever having had any personal contact, so he seemed like a good one to start with. Whether he would agree to see us or talk with us was an open question. The facts of the case were well documented. Edmund Amel Kemper III was born on December 18, 1948, in Burbank, California. He grew up with two younger sisters in a dysfunctional family in which his mother, Clarnell, and father, Ed Jr., fought constantly and eventually separated. After Ed displayed a range of weird behavior, including the dismemberment of two family cats and playing death ritual games with his older sister, Susan, his mother packed him off to her estranged husband. When he ran away and went back to his mother, he was sent to live with his paternal grandparents on a remote California farm at the foothills of the Sierras. There he was miserably bored and lonely, cut off from his family and the little comfort that the familiar surroundings of his own school afforded him. And there, one afternoon in August of 1963, the tall, hulking 14-year-old shot his grandmother, Maud, with a .22-caliber rifle, then stabbed her body repeatedly with a kitchen knife. She'd insisted he stay and help her with the household chores, rather than accompany his grandfather, whom he liked better, into the fields. Knowing Grandpa Ed wouldn't find what he had just done acceptable behavior, when the old man returned home, Ed shot him too, and left the body lying in the yard. When questioned by the police afterward, he shrugged and said, "I just wondered how it would feel to shoot Grandma." The seeming motivelessness of the double murder got Ed a diagnosis of personality trait disturbance, passive-aggressive type, and a commitment to the Atascadero State Hospital for the criminally insane. He was let out in 1969 at age 21, over the objection of state psychiatrists, and placed in the custody of his mother, who had left her third husband and was now working as a secretary at the newly opened University of California at Santa Cruz. By now, Ed Kemper was 6'9" and weighed in at around 300 pounds. For 2 years, he held odd jobs, cruising the streets and highways in his car, and made a practice of picking up young female hitchhikers. Santa Cruz and its environs seemed to be a magnet for beautiful California co-eds, and Kemper had missed out on a lot in his teens. Though turned down for the highway patrol, he got a job with the State Highway Department. On May 7, 1972, he picked up two roommates from Fresno State College, Marianne Pesci and Anita Lucchesa. He drove them to a secluded area, stabbed both young women to death, then took their bodies home to his mother's house where he took Polaroid photos, dissected them, and played with various organs. Then he packed up what was left in plastic bags, buried the bodies in the Santa Cruz Mountains, and tossed the heads into the deep ravine beside the road. On September 14th, Kemper gave a ride to a 15-year-old high school girl, Aiko Ku, suffocated her, sexually assaulted her corpse, then brought it home for dissection. The next morning, when he had one of his periodic visits with state psychiatrists to monitor and evaluate his mental health, Ku's head was lying in his car trunk. The interview went well, though, and the psychiatrist declared him no longer a threat to himself or others and recommended that his juvenile record be sealed. Kemper reveled in this brilliantly symbolic act. It demonstrated his contempt for the system and his superiority to it at the same time. He drove back to the mountains and buried the pieces of Ku's body near Boulder Creek. At the time Kemper was active, Santa Cruz could boast the unenviable title of serial murder capital of the world. Herbert Mullen, a bright, handsome, diagnosed paranoid schizophrenic, was killing both men and women, he claimed, at the urging of voices directing him to help save the environment. On a similar theme, a 24-year-old recluse car mechanic who lived in the woods outside of town, John Lindley Frazier, had burned down a house and killed a family of six as a warning to those who would destroy nature. "Materialism must die or mankind must stop," was the note left under the windshield wiper of the family's Rolls-Royce. It seemed as if every week another outrage was taking place. On January 9th of 1973, Kemper picked up Santa Cruz student Cindy Shaw, forced her into his trunk at gunpoint, then shot her. As had become his custom, he carried her body back to his mother's house, had sex with it in his bed, dissected it in the bathtub, then bagged the remains and flung them over the cliff into the ocean at Carmel. His innovation this time was to bury Shaw's head face up in the backyard, looking toward his mother's bedroom window, since she'd always wanted people to look up to her. By now, Santa Cruz was gripped with terror of the co-ed killer. Young women were warned not to accept rides from strangers, particularly from people outside the supposedly safe confines of the university community. But Kemper's mother worked for the college, and so he had a university sticker on his car. Less than a month later, Kemper picked up Rosalind Thorpe and Alice Liu, both of whom he shot, then piled in the trunk. They received the same treatment as his previous victims when he got them home. He dumped their mutilated bodies in Eden Canyon near San Francisco, where they were found a week later. His compulsion to kill was escalating at an alarming rate, even to him. He considered shooting everyone on the block, but finally decided against it. He had a better idea, what he realized he'd been wanting to do all along. On Easter weekend, as his mother slept in her bed, Kemper went into her room and attacked her repeatedly with a claw hammer until she died. He then decapitated her and raped her headless corpse. As his final inspirational touch, he cut out her larynx and fed it down the garbage disposal. It seemed appropriate, he later told police, as much as she'd bitched and screamed and yelled at me over so many years. But when he turned on the switch, the disposal jammed, and threw the bloody voice box back out at him. Even when she was dead, she was still bitching at me. I couldn't get her to shut up. He then called Sally Hallett, a friend of his mother's, inviting her over for a surprise dinner. When she arrived, he clubbed and strangled her, cut off her head, and left the body in his own bed while he went to sleep in his mother's bed. On Easter Sunday morning, he took off in his car, driving aimlessly eastward. He kept listening to the radio, expecting to have become a huge national celebrity. Yet there was nothing. Outside of Pueblo, Colorado, dazed and exhausted from lack of sleep, disappointed that his grand gesture had not had more of an impact, he pulled over at a phone booth beside the road, called the Santa Cruz Police Department, and after repeated attempts to convince them he was telling the truth, confessed to the murders and his identity as the co-ed killer. He then waited patiently as local police were dispatched to pick him up. Kemper was convicted on 8 counts of first-degree murder. When asked what he considered to be the appropriate punishment, he replied, "Death by torture." Though John Conway had made advance arrangements with the prison officials, I decided it was best to request interviews with the prisoners cold when we got there. Even though that meant making the trip without the certainty of cooperation, it seemed the best idea. Nothing stays secret in a prison, and if word got out that a certain inmate had a relationship with or was talking to the FBI, he could be considered a snitch or worse. If we showed up unannounced, it would be clear to the prison population that we were investigating something or other and didn't have any prior arrangement or deal. So I was somewhat surprised when Ed Kemper readily agreed to talk to us. Apparently, no one had asked him anything about his crimes for quite some time, and he was curious about what we were doing. Going into a high-security penitentiary is a chilling experience, even for a federal law enforcement agent. The first thing you have to do is surrender your gun. Obviously, they don't want any weapons available in the lockup areas. The second requirement is that you sign a waiver stating that you absolve the prison system of responsibility if you're taken hostage and understand that in such an eventuality, you will not be bargained for. Having an FBI agent as a hostage could be an enormous bargaining chip. Those formalities having been taken care of, Bob Ressler, John Conway, and I were ushered into a room with a table and chairs to await Ed Kemper's arrival. The first thing that struck me when they brought him in was how huge this guy was. I'd known that he was tall and had been considered a social outcast in school and in the neighborhood because of his size. But up close, he was enormous. He could easily have broken any of us in two. He had longish dark hair and a full mustache, and wore an open work shirt and white T-shirt that prominently displayed a massive gut. It was also apparent before long that Kemper was a bright guy. Prison records listed his IQ as 145, and at times during the many hours we spent with him, Bob and I worried he was a lot brighter than we were. He'd had a long time to sit and think about his life and crimes, and once he understood that we'd carefully researched his files and would know if he was bullshitting us, he opened up and talked about himself for hours. His attitude was neither cocky and arrogant, nor remorseful and contrite. Rather, he was cool and soft-spoken, analytical and somewhat removed. In fact, as the interview went on, it was often difficult to break in and ask a question. The only times he got weepy was in recalling his treatment at the hands of his mother. Having taught applied criminal psychology without necessarily knowing that everything I was saying was true, I was interested in the age-old question of whether criminals are born or made. Though there's still no definitive answer, and may never be, listening to Kemper raised some fascinating questions. There was no dispute that Ed's parents had had a terrible marriage. He told us that from early on, he'd looked so much like his father that his mother had hated him. Then his size became an issue. By the time he was 10, he was almost a giant for his age, and Clarnell worried that he would molest his sister Susan. So she made him sleep in a windowless basement room near the furnace. Every night at bedtime, Clarnell would close the basement door on him while she and Susan went to their rooms upstairs. This terrified him and made him totally resentful of the two women. It also coincided with his mother's final breakup from Ed's father. Because of his size, shy personality, and lack of a role model in the house to identify with, Ed had always been withdrawn and different. Once he was shut up like a prisoner in the basement and made to feel dirty and dangerous without having done anything wrong, his hostile and murderous thoughts began to blossom. It was then that he killed and mutilated the two family cats, one with his pocket knife and the other with a machete. We would later realize that this childhood trait of cruelty to small animals was the keystone of what came to be known as the homicidal triad, also including enuresis, or bedwetting, beyond the normally appropriate age, and fire-starting. What was also sad and ironic was that at Santa Cruz, Ed's mother was popular with both administrators and students. She was considered a sensitive, caring person you could go to if you had a problem or just needed to talk something out. Yet at home, she treated her timid son as if he were some kind of monster. "There's no way you can ever date or marry any of these college co-eds," was her apparent message. "They're all much better than you." Continually exposed to that attitude, Ed eventually decided to fulfill her expectations. In her own way, it must be said, she did try to take care of him. When he expressed an interest in joining the California Highway Patrol, she endeavored to have his juvenile record expunged, so the stigma of having murdered his grandparents wouldn't hold him back in adult life. This desire to work with the police was another interesting revelation, which was to come up over and over again in our serial killer studies. The three most common motives of serial rapists and murderers turned out to be domination, manipulation, and control. When you consider that most of these guys are angry, ineffectual losers who feel they've been given the shaft by life, and that most of them have experienced some sort of physical or emotional abuse, as Ed Kemper had, it isn't surprising that one of their main fantasy occupations is police officer. A policeman represents power and public respect. When called upon to do so, he's authorized to hurt bad people for the common good. In our research, we discovered that while few police officers go bad and commit violent crimes, frequently serial offenders had failed in their efforts to join police departments and had taken jobs in related fields, such as security guard or night watchman. One of the things we began saying in some of our profiles was that the unsub would drive a police-like vehicle, say a Ford Crown Victoria or Chevrolet Caprice. Sometimes, as in the case of the Atlanta child murders, the subject had purchased a used and stripped police car. Even more common is the police buff. One of the things Ed Kemper told us was that he would frequent bars and restaurants known to be police hangouts and strike up conversations. This made him feel like an insider, gave him the vicarious thrill of a policeman's power. But also, once the co-ed killer was on the rampage, he had a direct line into the progress of the investigation, allowing him to anticipate their next move. In fact, when Kemper called from Colorado at the end of his long, bloody mission, he had a difficult time convincing the Santa Cruz cops that this wasn't all some drunken joke, that the co-ed killer was really their friend Ed. Now, because of what we've learned, we routinely consider the likelihood that a subject will attempt to insinuate himself into the investigation. Years later, working the Arthur Shawcross prostitute murders in Rochester, New York, my colleague Greg McCrary correctly predicted that the killer would turn out to be someone that many of the police knew well, who hung around their hangouts, and who enthusiastically pumped them for information. I was extremely interested in Kemper's methodology. that he was getting away with these crimes repeatedly in the same general geographical area meant that he was doing something right, that he was analyzing what he was doing and learning to perfect his technique. Keep in mind that for most of these guys, the hunting and killing is the most important thing in their lives, their main job, so they're thinking about it all the time. Ed Kemper got so good at what he did that when he was stopped one time for a broken taillight while he had two bodies in his trunk, the officer reported how polite he was and let him off with a warning. Rather than being terrified of discovery and arrest, this was part of the thrill to Kemper. He dispassionately told us that had the officer looked in his trunk, he was prepared to kill him. Another time, he talked his way past a university security guard with two women dying of gunshot wounds in the car. Both were wrapped in blankets up to their necks, one next to him in the front seat, the other in the back. Kemper calmly and somewhat embarrassedly explained that the girls were drunk and he was taking them home. The last part of the statement was true. And on one occasion, he picked up a woman hitchhiking with her young, teenaged son, planning to kill them both. But as he drove away, he saw out of his rearview mirror that the woman's companion had written down his license plate number. So he rationally drove the mother and son to where they were going and dropped them off. As bright as he was, Kemper had actually administered psychological tests in prison. So he knew all the buzzwords and could give you an analysis of his behavior in analytical psychiatric detail. Everything about the crimes was part of the challenge, part of the game, even figuring out how to get the victims into the car without being suspicious. He told us that when he stopped his car for a pretty girl, he'd ask her where she was going, then glance at his watch as if trying to decide if he had enough time. Thinking that she was dealing with a busy man who had other more important priorities than stopping for hitchhikers would immediately put her at ease and erase any hesitations. Aside from giving us a look into a killer's modus operandi, this type of information would start suggesting something important. The normal, common-sense assumptions, verbal cues, body language, and so on that we use to size up other people and make instant judgments about them often don't apply to sociopaths. With Ed Kemper, for instance, stopping for a pretty hitchhiker was his most important priority, and he had thought long, hard, and analytically about how best to accomplish his objective. Much longer, harder, and more analytically than a young woman encountering him casually would have done from her perspective. Manipulation, domination, control. These are the three watchwords of violent serial offenders. Everything they do and think about is directed toward assisting them in filling their otherwise inadequate lives. Probably the most crucial single factor in the development of a serial rapist or killer is the role of fantasy. And I mean this in its broadest sense. Ed Kemper's fantasies developed early, and they all involve the relationship between sex and death. The game he made his sister play with him involved binding him to a chair as if he were in the gas chamber. His sexual fantasies involving others ended with the partner's death and dismemberment. Because of his feelings of inadequacy, Kemper didn't feel comfortable with normal boy-girl relationships. He didn't think any girl would have him. So in his own mind, he compensated. He had to completely possess his imagined partner, and that meant ultimately possessing her life. Alive, they were distant, not sharing with me, he explained in a confession introduced in court. I was trying to establish a relationship. When they were being killed, there wasn't anything going on in my mind except that they were going to be mine. With most sexually based killers, it's a several-step escalation from the fantasy to the reality, often fueled by pornography, morbid experimentation on animals, and cruelty to peers. This last trait can be seen by the subject as getting back at them for bad treatment. In Kemper's case, he felt shunned and tormented by the other children because of his size and personality. and he told us that before he dismembered the two family cats, he'd stolen one of his sister's dolls and cut off its head and hands, practicing what he was planning for living beings. On another level, Kemper's overriding fantasy was to rid himself of his domineering, abusive mother, and everything he did as a killer can be analyzed in that context. Please don't get me wrong. This in no way excuses what he did. Everything in my background and experience tells me that people are responsible for what they do. But in my opinion, Ed Kemper's an example of someone not born a serial killer, but manufactured as one. Would he have had the same murderous fantasies had he had a more stable and nurturing home life? Who knows? But would he have acted on them in the same fashion had he not had this incredible rage against the dominant female personality in his life? I don't think so, because the entire progress of Kemper's career as a killer can be seen as an attempt to get back at dear old Mom. When he finally worked himself up to that final act, the drama was played out.
This ends side two of cassette three of Mindhunter. Please fast forward to the end before loading cassette four.